this time on Weather Brains.
How would I feel if I did not issue a warning and somebody died because I didn't?
We get a close-up look at the agency that issues severe thunderstorm and tornado watches.
I think we have gotten very good at identifying outbreak environments.
Join us as we talk with a member of the National Weather Service's Storm Prediction Center in Oklahoma.
In your opinion, after doing this for a long time, do we have a problem in this country with a high FAR among tornado warnings, false alarm ratio?
Plus, some thoughts on how folks react to what some consider severe weather forecasts gone bad.
We're getting so self-centered now. You know, if I don't have an F5 tornado in my neighborhood, then it's a bust. And that's just insane.
That and more coming up. Hello and welcome to Weather Brains, the podcast that's all about weather, put together by a bunch of weather geeks out of Birmingham, Alabama. I'm David Black on behalf of the Weather Company. With us for this podcast is James Spann, chief meteorologist of the ABC affiliate in Birmingham, as well as J.B. Elliott. Hello to James and to J.B. How you doing, Mr. Spann?
Hey, David, I'm doing great. How are you?
I am superb, as usual. And JB, I trust you're kicking and hanging in steady, too?
NC, no change.
All right, real good. We've got a very interesting and special podcast on tap this time. We've got a special guest with us, and we have got a real opportunity to find out about severe weather forecasting and detection in this country. We want to say hello and a thank you for joining us to Dan McCarthy, the Warning Coordination Meteorologist with the National Weather Service's Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma. Right, Dan?
That's right. That's correct.
Now, a Warning Coordination Meteorologist, what exactly do you do for the SPC?
Well, my main function here is for outreach for the Storm Prediction Center, try to get the message out about the Storm Prediction Center, what we do. I also get to interact with a lot with our partners, which contain broadcast meteorologists as well as emergency managers, and not so much emergency managers on the local level, but on the state and federal level as well. So I get to interact with FEMA and those organizations. And I also get to keep the tornado database, and so I get to see a lot of tornadoes or pictures of tornadoes during the year.
Folks have heard of the Storm Prediction Center for a long time because that name is always included in the text of severe thunderstorm watches, tornado watches. You guys, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, you guys issue the watches for those types of weather for anywhere in the country. Is that right?
That's correct. We used to be known as the National Severe Storm Forecast Center back in the days, about 10 years ago now. When we moved to Norman, Oklahoma, we became the Storm Prediction Center. And yes, we do issue the severe thunderstorm and tornado watches in coordination with the weather forecast offices in those areas.
We've seen some interesting changes over the years, I have, and I want to ask you about these. And James and JB will have some questions and comments, and we'll just kind of throw all these in the mix as we go along. First off, from a fairly technical perspective, you guys at the SPC have been doing something that is a bit on the new side here. You've started issuing moderate risk outlooks when appropriate on day two in advance of severe weather. Is that correct?
That's right. In fact, we've even gone to a point where we can go high risk on day two and moderate risk out to 3 days in advance.
Now, we're always told to expect the unexpected with thunderstorms. So I've got a question, Dan. Does this mean that you are nonetheless confident enough about severe storm behavior to warn people about that kind of weather that far in advance?
Well, you have to remember that it's not so much the behavior that we're forecasting for as we are the environments. I think we have gotten very good at identifying outbreak environments. I think we are getting better in locating environments that are just marginal or a little bit better than marginal that can produce more than 10 or 15 tornadoes. So we have some new things here. We've had some of our forecasters put some things together that really start to identify better areas where supercells can develop, and then also identify in those areas what happens in the lowest 1,000 feet or 3,000 feet that make those supercells possibly produce significant tornadoes.
So what I'm hearing from you is that the past 10, 5 years even have brought about some interesting advances in technology to detect severe weather in advance?
It's not so much technology as it is the combination of model data improvements as well as identifying through the study of several what we call proximity soundings. In other words, that's upper air soundings in the proximity where tornadoes have formed in the past, to identify environments and wind shear instability combinations that can produce tornadoes.
What sort of criteria do you go by, Dan, in determining whether a watch was valid, if it was a good call, or if it was a bust?
Well, I think, number one, if you issue a tornado watch, I get to forecast and issue watches myself, but if I issue a tornado watch, I get one tornado, I think it's good. If I get three, four, five tornadoes, it's better. If I get 10 tornadoes, it's a pretty good watch. If I issue a severe thunderstorm watch and I get six reports, in my mind, if they're an inch diameter or better, that's a good watch. If I issue a tornado watch and I include the particularly dangerous situation buzzwords in it, and I have a tornado that causes F3 or F4 damage somewhere, then that's a worthwhile watch as well.
What about when you use the term particularly dangerous situation? We've had some PDS watches. What constitutes a valid or a verified PDS watch?
Well, number one, we'll automatically include that wording with a high risk. If we're going with a high risk for that particular day, we issue a watch within that high risk, it automatically gets to particularly dangerous situation. Because when you go high risk, then you're pretty confident that you're going to get damaging tornadoes, if not destructive tornadoes. On top of that, if I issue the particularly dangerous situation and I get a situation where a tornado causes F3 damage like it did through Tennessee just a little under a month ago, yet maybe nobody dies or only two fatalities occur, then that particularly dangerous situation was warranted.
What about the case where you issue perhaps multiple watches, case in point, North Alabama, and central sections of the state? Folks in the central sections of the state don't see much, if any, activity. Maybe this is even a PDS. But then 100 miles to the north, they get the daylights hammered out of them. As far as the folks are concerned further south, they wonder what was all the ruckus about. Do you have any problems, issues with trying to resolve that with the public when their perception, because of where they are, is that you made a bad call?
No, I wouldn't call that a bad call, because we cannot put out forecasts like hurricanes where we can give you a path how a tornado is going to form. Tornadoes are a random act. Tornadoes are a random occurrence with supercell storms. If I have a watch that only covers three or four counties, well, that's just a glorified warning, really. So what I'm trying to do is tell the public, this is the area where the best wind shear, the best instability is coming together. We could have more thunderstorms that develop south of this line. So this is what I'm looking for. Now, what we've done starting on April 25th that made it official, we're putting probabilities in our watches now. So you can see exactly what the biggest threat of the probability is. So if we go into a watch and you have a 35% probability of tornadoes, you're looking at a 1 in 3 chance that a tornado is going to affect you within 25 nautical miles.
You know, for you to be able to make a projection like that with the probabilities product tells me that you can really analyze what's going on a much higher resolution, finer scale. Is that correct?
Yes, that is somewhat correct, because we're looking at model data that now goes down to what we call 12 kilometers rather than the usual models that you may see on the internet that might be 40 kilometers. So we have 20 and 12 kilometers as well. Plus we have the rapid update cycle, which uses the basis from the model from that morning, but uses observational data from surface as well as upper air, radar, and satellite data to fine-tune the area we're looking for. So if my confidence continues to grow as the day goes on, and I have a pretty good idea conceptually what's going to happen, then my confidence and my probabilities are going to go up.
Are there ever cases where a watch is issued more or less to be on the safe side, so to speak, as opposed to having a more well-defined, understood severe weather threat?
Well, the thing you have to realize, we get into situations where You know, our watches now are issued by county. They're not issued by the parallelogram like they have been for 30 or 40 years in the past. So in order to go through the process to coordinate with the weather forecast offices and to issue it by county so that everybody issues the watch all at the same time, no longer do we issue watches when conditions are favorable. We have to issue watches and forecast when conditions are going to be favorable. We'd like to have a tornado watch out, and we're averaging pretty good at doing this. We have to issue a tornado watch about an hour and a half to 2 hours before anything develops. Okay? So most likely you're going to be in a watch, and yes, it's going to be partly cloudy or it's going to be mostly sunny. But what we're trying to tell you first with the outlook is that you're in a situation today where severe weather can occur in your area. That is the time that you are to get ready for severe weather. Make sure your safe place has the things you need for a safe place in case you have to take cover there sometime during today. Something like that. When the watch is issued, what we're trying to tell people is, okay, the atmosphere is set now to produce severe thunderstorms or tornadoes. Now is the time that you need to tune in to your local meteorologist, NOAA weather radio, radio broadcast, whatever you need to keep informed of what's going on either in your area, in your county, or to the counties to your west, so that when the weather forecast office issues a tornado warning, you can get to cover immediately. That's when you go to safety. So it's a ready, set, go concept.
What's in the future, Dan? What is your forecasting ability going to be like if you had a crystal ball to look at, say, 5, 6, 7 years down the road? How much more accurately do you see being able to make these kinds of forecasts?
Well, we've done very well in the 5 outbreaks this year in forecasting more than 3 days out. We've been experimenting with a day 4 to 8 forecast, and we've been doing very well.
Hey, I like that 4 to 8 outlook.
We've done a very good job in estimating that. It's going to be interesting to see how well we do when you get into the summertime when the flow is weak and things like that. That's when the real challenge is going to be. Model data now is going to be what we call the WARF system, which is an ability for a model, for example. We're going to be able to adjust our own physics. We're going to be able to adjust certain things in the model to see, well, what's it going to take for me to get the best atmosphere with this kind of pattern, these kind of conditions.
Do you think that 4 to 8 outlook will at one time will become operational instead of experimental?
I think possibly early next year it could be. So, you know, right now it's experimental to the public, and we're getting feedback. We're getting a lot of great feedback with that and our enhanced thunder forecasts. So that has become a popular product. So as long as we have that kind of feedback, I think that those products will become operational.
Hey, Dan, this is James. David really touched on this. He asked kind of a broad question. I want to focus in on the event of April 7th of this year. That was the Gallatin, Tennessee tornado. To my knowledge, and I want to ask you, is that the first time that you've ever put out a high risk on day two?
Yes, it is the first time we put out a high risk on day two.
Do you feel that was a good call?
I thought that was a bullseye of a call.
Yeah, and here's where David was going with that question, Dan. You know, Tennessee was hammered, and down here where we are in the Birmingham market, we didn't have, you know, those kind of tornadoes down here, and you had a lot of people that just decided that high risk was a bust. The whole thing was blown out of proportion. These people are, you know, crying wolf. Some of the schools closed down here early in the day Friday, and as it turned out, the storms didn't really get down here until after midnight that night. And Brian Peters wrote a brilliant blog post, I think, on our blog called High Risk Buster Brilliant. He was defending your position, and I think I'm exactly in his camp. And I was going to say, what is your response to those people here that thought that whole thing was blown out of proportion?
Well, anytime we go high risk, we're not fooling around. I mean, I think to have the high risk and then nudge it towards northern Alabama, well, what if we had another line that developed on that outflow boundary? Then we would have had the same conditions, because the capping inversion was really south of Birmingham that afternoon, that evening. So there was still that possibility that even though we had a long track tornado or a couple long track tornadoes from northeast Arkansas into Tennessee and then across Nashville area, all it took was another line to develop, but unfortunately did not develop. We were still very much unstable. We still had some favorable shear around the area. I thought it was a very good forecast, especially 2 days out.
Well, I do too. And, you know, I think it's a function of society. We're getting so self-centered now. You know, if I don't have an F5 tornado in my neighborhood, then it's a bust. And that's just insane. I don't see how anybody could call that a bust when they could see what happened in Tennessee. And quite frankly, we had a lot of damage down here. I mean, it was pretty bad. And it's just like now, if you don't get, you know, an F5 tornado in the backyard, it's a bust. And I'm afraid
we've been busting a lot of forecasts then, James, because we haven't had an F5 damaged tornado since May 3rd in 1999.
Yep, that's it. So, and that brings to... Go
ahead,
JB. But
consider that you put out a high risk, okay? Unfortunately, you still had numerous people perish in that. Okay, and yes, the damage was rated F3. If you're in a situation where the conditions are favorable, and then you're sitting in a weather forecast office and you're looking at radar, and you think, oh, this thing can't produce an F3 tornado, and you don't issue a warning, then what's the reaction going to be?
But I guess tying back to what James is saying, I can see some members of the public who would be in an area where they really didn't have any major damage or tornadic activity, I can see their perception being, you guys blew it. No, nothing happened around here in my backyard. I tend to wonder if you're going to be gearing up and getting ready to deal with that sort of response as the future goes on and you do more day two moderates and high risks.
Maybe so, but I'd rather have a moderate high risk out in a situation like that than a slight risk and people don't pay attention to it because, it's only a slight risk. Here was volatile situation.
Hey, Dan, I have a question about tornado ratings. I want to shift gears.
Well, we didn't answer the question, though. I mean,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
To go a moderate or high risk day two out and then do it that day, and you didn't get something maybe in your backyard, but something happened within 100 miles or 250 miles from you, that's pretty close when you consider severe weather forecasting and how small of a scale that's going to be. You know, what if there was just a slight risk and you had those long track tornadoes? I think we'd receive more criticism in that situation than if I had a high risk and it just didn't go as far south as we originally thought.
Do you ever feel danged if you do and danged if you don't in your business?
Yes. But on the same token, when you consider that we're averaging 55 fatalities a year now, where 20 years ago we were averaging 100, 30 years ago we had days where we had 300 fatalities, I think that's a heck of an improvement.
And some part of every high risk is not going to verify. Otherwise, it would be a major disaster every time.
Well, that might be true.
I just think it's a function of people are so self-centered now. It's just a societal change. But Dan, let me ask you this. Brian Peters has been telling us that now the local Weather Service offices cannot go in and determine tornado damage to be F4, F5 unless there is a special go team from the Weather Service to come in. Is that true?
It's called the Quick Response Team.
Okay.
And the Quick Response Team was developed after the La Plata, Maryland storm was rated F4 damage and 20 minutes later was raised to F5 damage. When you talk about areas in the south central part of the U.S., the southeastern part of the U.S., we have people like Brian Peters, who served with me on the Enhanced Fujita Scale team, that have done numerous surveys and have the experience to continue to do surveys. The Quick Response Team is in order to have experienced people come in and do surveys so you can get a more consistent survey across the board. No longer do you, you know, sometimes we get it fall into this trap that my tornado is bigger than your tornado. Okay? Now we're going to the Enhanced Fujita Scale here in February of 2007, which is enhanced because we have 28 damage indicators. Each one of those damage indicators have 6 to 10 degrees of damage to radar, so we'll have more consistent ratings across the board.
Who determines when a quick response team needs to come in? Is that done by the local weather service, or is that done by SPC, or who makes that call?
Well, a good example is when we had the tornadoes on April 7th that James was talking about. We were doing surveys north of Nashville. Nashville Weather Office did the damage survey, and there were homes that were $500,000. There were $500,000 homes, brick, stone homes. And he thought it might be F4 damage rating. But what he did was call on Tim Marshall, who is one of the experts in our field because he has degrees not only in meteorology but engineering as well, and has done extensive studies in damage from hurricanes and tornadoes. And they conferred that it was F3 because even though these homes were worth $500,000, they still were not strapped to the foundation. I think what we're finding out is maybe our homes aren't constructed as well as they should be.
A lot of shoddy building going on.
Yeah, we first started to discover this in the May 3rd, 1999 tornado in Oklahoma City when we did a study with FEMA on where people took cover, how did the homes break down. And we found that there weren't hurricane clips in the roofs. There were not straps to the foundation. The weight of the house was keeping the house on the foundation. So when you find those kind of weaknesses, then maybe the wind speeds weren't as high as you thought to cause that kind of damage.
By the way, Dan, we had Tim on this show last week. We try and just get the really smart guys on here. That's the reason we called you.
That's why we're calling you. Let me ask you this. You obviously rely very heavily on the data that comes in from balloon soundings in severe weather detection. You guys occasionally will do special soundings, will you not, when you anticipate a major severe weather threat?
That's right. If we have a moderate or high risk out for that particular day, we'll call first the station duty meteorologist in D.C. and then coordinate with local weather forecast offices when four extra soundings, possibly around noon or 1 o'clock that particular day.
Are there ever any issues with funding operations like that? Is that any kind of a struggle for you guys at all?
No, there's never any issues like that.
Hey, Dan, let me ask you a question.
In fact, sometimes I get offices calling us and say we're going to do an extra sounding. We say, great.
Dan, in your opinion, do we have a – and I know you guys don't issue the local warnings, but in your opinion, after doing this for a long time, do we have a problem in this country with a high FAR among tornado warnings, false alarm ratio?
Let me tell you this. If I had to sit down in front of a radar screen – and I had two pixels that were showing me 50 knots of gate-to-gate shear, why would I not issue a warning just in case a tornado develops out of that? How would I feel if I did not issue a warning and somebody died because I didn't? It's very simple recognition on radar with your storm spotters are seeing with that storm whether there's any rotation to it. I would rather have a tornado warning out to protect the public and make sure they are protecting their lives rather than sit there and debate over whether I need a warning or not, then a tornado occurs and 10 people die.
So you don't believe that there's a public problem with the cry wolf syndrome then with the warnings we have now?
I don't think there should be. I'd rather be on the safe side than not have something out and then I die because somebody didn't issue a warning.
I guess one of the things that I'm concerned about, Dan, is that I just wonder if sometimes tornado warnings are going the way of severe thunderstorm warnings down here in this part of the country. I don't know of anybody in my neighborhood where I live that really does anything when a severe thunderstorm warning is issued. And we all know that all severe thunderstorms are not alike. You get some of these derecho events where they're just, 100-mile-an-hour winds, and it's just like horrible damage. But, a lot of times you're talking hail. I just wonder, if we have so many warnings, is the public becoming deaf to these warnings now?
Is there a complacency setting in?
I hope not. Even with a severe thunderstorm warning, windows can be broken out. I've seen trampolines airborne due to winds. Some have said maybe we need to assign a level to our warnings, but I don't think so. I mean, when the National Weather Service issues a severe thunderstorm warning, it's because radar says that there's a possibility And it's the same situation again. If I have a pixel on radar that says it's 50 knots, do I take a chance and say, it's not going to do a whole lot of damage? Or do I issue the warning so that the public knows, hey, there's a threat here that we're going to have severe weather?
Did I see where some forecast offices were experimenting this year with 65 mph winds and 1-inch diameter hail before issuing a warning?
Well, I know there's an experiment in the central part of the U.S. as far as 1-inch hail is concerned, but I did not know that hurricane force was going to be the minimum on some other offices.
Well, 65 mph, not 70.
Okay, 65, that's what, 56 knots? I did not hear about that, but, you know, I was just going through the 2005 data this afternoon and noticed numerous reports where there were estimated and measured gusts of only 30 knots, and there were reports of trees and power lines down with those. So it's one of those situations where do I issue the warning and take a chance that something happens, or do I just put the warning out so that the public is informed? The whole idea is to make the public aware of the situation that is at hand. And that is the important thing, to make the public aware of the situation. Situation awareness not only with us, but it's with the public as well.
Let me ask you this. What are the possibilities of a tornado emergency becoming a formal message within the National Weather Service to be a level above a tornado warning? That's when you've got known tornado damage. Spotters are looking at it. You know it's down. I know some offices use that in severe weather statements. Is there any thought or idea of a tornado emergency message becoming a formal message?
I think that is always an option. It works so well with the Oklahoma City tornado back in 1999. And it worked so well again in Kansas City on May 4th, 2003, that I think that option is always there. The Weather Service really has the leeway, the local offices have the leeway to do what they need to do in order to serve the public, in order to protect life and property, more life than anything else.
Dan, there was talk at one point sometime back about the issuance of watches being turned over to local forecast offices. What happened to that?
A lot of the opinions from the local offices were finally heard that they don't have the manpower possibly to take over issuing the watches. They like the idea of one center overlooking the situation. What they really wanted was input into the watch issuance, and so that's why we went to the route to where we identify the area, then we coordinate with those local offices, and then issue the watch.
Sounds like job security for you guys.
Very much so. Because it enables, you know, right now, when you really think about it, offices are now issuing warnings by polygon. They're no longer full counties. They're just part of counties or something like that, identifying the threat area of the storms. And so when you really think about that, watch by county is probably just a step behind there. We need to go to a polygon watch situation to where we can identify more accurately areas that have the threat. So, yeah, it's just that advancement has come so much with not only radar but with our model data and our observational data that we're trying to keep up with this. But to get back to your question, this way we get to not oversee, but at least coordinate with those offices. So, like, for example, you don't get a watch that's issued in the Jackson forecast office, not the Birmingham office, but then another office like Atlanta does want to watch, so you don't get the gaps or something like that. And it's much easier to coordinate then with those offices that say, well, rather than issuing three watches across our area, why don't you just issue one big watch that covers most of our areas, and we'll be covered for about eight hours now instead of six.
Well, you touched on something I wanted to ask you. Look into your crystal ball at a severe weather watch, thunderstorm, or tornado issued for Alabama in April 10 years from now. What sort of area do you think would be covered? How small scale do you think you guys might be able to have it? And what sort of specific predictions do you or would you like to envision that you might be able to provide?
I'd like it to the point where we can define not a rectangle and maybe not by county, but I can draw a trapezoid that can specifically define an area that I know that needs to be in a watch for the next 6 to 8, maybe even 10 hours.
And by then you'll have GOES-R. Have you heard of that?
Yes, I have, and it's going to be interesting if I can get down to a neighborhood and see what the clouds are. I mean, that'd be kind of cool. But the whole point being that we're limited. You got to realize, and get James to chime in on this, there is still one aspect about severe weather forecasting that has not changed, and that's our upper air soundings are still 250 miles apart, and they're only taken twice a day. Okay? We're not getting the full picture or the full change of the atmosphere vertically. We really, really need to. And we can't rely on model data to tell us what we're trying to do, and that's make a forecast. Profiler data was an excellent opportunity to help us see how winds change hourly across a certain area. Doppler radar can help us, but sometimes doesn't take the whole vertical picture. If we can have a way where we can take 4 soundings a day and take that 250-mile resolution and cut it in half and even make it every 150 miles, we can really get a good idea how the atmosphere is changing with time in order to really, really forecast severe storms.
What's holding us back on the 4 soundings a day? Is it budget issues?
Oh, very much so. I think it is, because now, you know, you're using now technology that really started back in the 50s, maybe even the 40s. We were using in World War II. And even though we now have data that instantaneously, or tools that instantaneously send the data back to us, we're still just taking it twice a day. There have been experiments with airplanes taking soundings. There are experiments that we can take satellite soundings and things like that. We really need to get a three-dimensional idea of what the atmosphere is doing. Now, as we progress down the road also, we're going to get this phased array in here sometime in the next 15 to 20 years to where we don't have rotational parts on radar anymore. We're taking minute-by-minute pictures of a storm as it develops, and that may give us that key, that little secret key. What goes on that lowest 1 kilometer? What goes on right there that makes that tornado? You know, you don't necessarily need a cool rear flank downdraft. Maybe you just need a drier one. What is the key that makes that one storm produce a tornado and the other storm doesn't? So that's the kind of thing we really need to get into.
Now, speaking of phased array, Dan, I was going to ask about that and your new building out there, this World Weather Headquarters thing. Are you guys in that deal yet? And if not, how far is that going to be?
Well, the Severe Storm Lab is already packing up. They're throwing things out, things like that. Right. They're going to start moving here probably in a couple weeks. The Severe Storm Lab is the first ones that are going to get into that new building. And then there are certain entities in the University of Oklahoma and some of the companies that are with the University of Oklahoma that will start moving in as well. As far as the Storm Prediction Center, people like me, the administration, Dr. Sho, Schaefernet, we're going to move in August, and the operation starts moving in September.
Cool. So where is the phased array radar going to be built out there?
Well, the phased array radar is right outside the old Severe Storm Laboratory building right now, and this will become more of a radar experiment operation center here. The radar operations center is going to expand, and then they'll be able to do experiments with the Department of Defense with that radar.
I got you. And I got one more question that JB wants to ask a couple, and we'll let you go, Dan. The national media guys have decided that because of global warming, we're going to have more tornadoes than ever before in the next 20 years, and we're all going to have death, doom, and destruction. What's your take on global warming?
What happened last May? We only had 128 tornadoes in the whole country last May. Was that global warming? We had 500 each of the 2 years before that. Was that global warming? It's really hard to say. To me, climatological reasonings take hundreds, 500s of years to figure out whether it's global warming or not. Tornadoes are too much of a random type of phenomena for me to say, yeah, it's because of global warming. I think it's because we have more observations out there. We have more people out there to observe tornadoes and things like that, that we might be getting more activity. I'm not sold that it's totally on global warming yet. I'm not sold that because we only had 128 tornadoes last May that there's something going on. I was asked that question by CNN one morning. I said, you know, it's 22 degrees here. If there was global warming, I don't think it'd be that cold.
You know, I can't find an operational meteorologist that's a global warming guy. I mean, no, I'm not, and I don't know of anybody else that is, so I'm just trying to – I ask that question waiting for somebody to say, yeah, it's global warming, and all I can say to that is amen. So, JB, go ahead.
Dan, I was fascinated by a story in USA Today, today's edition, about GOES-R, which will be launched about 6 years from now and is going to cost $6 to $8 billion. NOAA is in Denver now in a conference developing plans for it, and is supposed to gather 50 times as much data, three times more often every 5 minutes, and it's specified that it would be very useful to severe weather operations and not just hurricane forecasting. But the other question I wanted to ask, the National Weather Service here now, and I guess a lot of them are issuing tornado warnings or severe thunderstorm warnings for small portions of one county, often a small county, like a tornado warning for West Central Bibb County. Just a slight change in direction of the path or speeding up will cause them to have to issue another tornado warning 5 or 10 minutes later, and that's causing a lot of confusion.
Yeah, I can understand where it would. What the local offices are experimenting with is called polygon warnings. And rather than issue a warning for a whole county and put a whole county on alert, they're only issuing for part of a county. Then as soon as maybe a storm splits or something like that, or a storm makes a right-hand turn due to its shear or its storm relative shear, then it'll have to issue another warning.
The bad part about that is a lot of people are semi-ignorant when it comes to geography, and they scratch their head when they hear West Central Bibb County.
Yeah, I guess. You know, not having to issue warnings myself, I don't know exactly how to respond to that. It's a real good attempt, and I think it's a good idea. In fact, you can even go to the local page there for the Birmingham Weather Forecast Office and look at a radar, what they call Ridge, which will give you topography and everything, and it'll show those polygon warnings to you and let you see exactly what they're warning on and what the storms are doing. So, like I said, when you're a radar operator, you are really, really under the gun, because what you're trying to do is provide a service to people where they can protect themselves from the storm.
I know what you mean. I was in the weather service for 32 years.
Well, then you've been under the gun before, right?
Yes.
JB launched first balloon ever in the history of the Weather Service, Dan.
Oh, that's right. We had that long conversation about the April 3rd outbreak, didn't we?
Yes, and we, even back in the late 50s when we had the old WSR-3 radar, black and white radar, you remember that?
Oh, yes. Barely. I'm still too young.
Now, I was going to ask you another question, Dan. You came out of the television world. For those of you that don't know, Dan did television weather, I guess, what, 20 years ago? And
it's getting closer to 25.
One more question. You know, times have changed. I got into television in the late 70s, and there are certain markets in the country, and really I did identify three that come to mind. The one you're in, Oklahoma City, the one we're in, Birmingham, and Huntsville, which is north of here, are very aggressive weather markets. Do you see that as a plus for warning people, or do you think that television stations and those aggressive markets like that scare people and they're doing too much?
I can speak here in the Oklahoma City area. In fact, you'll find it very competitive from Central Texas up through Oklahoma. Wichita, Kansas is very competitive, and so is the Kansas City area. And I think what we've come here, and I think James will understand what I'm saying, is TV stations pay a lot of money for the latest technology so that people can easily interpret what the broadcast meteorologist is trying to say. I have to say, after being on both sides of the fence, the broadcast meteorologist plays a very key part in carrying our message in the National Weather Service. They are the delivery people. Okay? You cannot see radar by listening to NOAA weather radio, yet you know what's going on. But these people carry quite a message. They have excellent graphics now compared to what I had 20, 25 years ago to carry the message, okay? So, I can understand, I was upset one night because they're interrupting an NCAA tournament basketball game about just regular thunderstorms around the Oklahoma City area. But we have people out there who are very afraid of storms, who are very scared of storms, and sometimes just need to be calmed down just by the confidence that this person's saying, hey, there's nothing to this storm. Go about your business. We'll let you know if something's going on. I think it can be competitive, but you have to have trust in the person that's delivering the message, no matter who you select.
Well said.
Dan, you can probably tell by now that we are not weather brains. You are the weather brain. you've endured quite an ordeal, perhaps, from us. My big question to you is, after having tolerated this, would you be willing to talk with us again at some point in the future? That's the real question.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, Dan, when
this
you made the Weather Brains podcast, you're big time, man.
This was nothing close to my master's degree comprehensive exam, so.
Okay. I enjoyed it, Dan.
Well, I've enjoyed it, too. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dan.
Okay, James, good talking to you again.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right, Dan, thanks very much. That is Dan McCarthy, the Warning Coordination Meteorologist, National Weather Service, Storm Prediction Center, Norman, Oklahoma. Fascinating person to talk to, huh, James?
Yeah, I first met Dan, I don't know, probably, no telling, five. JB, when did we meet Dan over at Starkville? It's probably been 5 years.
I think it was 4 or 5 years ago. And little do is, although he did make a presentation at the conference that time.
Yeah, Dan can suck that barbecue. In fact, Dan worked on some ribs that night, as I recall, at the Dewey over there. But I also got to know Dan at a convention out in Spokane, Washington. All these things kind of run together in my mind. But he invited me to come out to Norman and speak at the National Severe Weather Workshop that they have every year, and kind of got indoctrinated into what they do out there at Norman. And Dan has got a great background, you know, coming from television. After he finished with a master's in meteorology, started doing television. Then he got into private sector. I think he worked for Weather Data out in Wichita. Then he got into the Weather Service. So I like the fact that he comes from all these different backgrounds, and he's been there and he's done that. And I think Dan does a great job out there at Norman, so I'm glad he's there.
Right.
I think, too, though, I really can't help but feel that they've got a really tough job ahead with the continuing refinements in technology. The Polygon watches, they're getting more and more precise, or trying to be, in both description and actual forecast accuracy. Yet, at the same time, I think it's going to be more and more of a challenge for a lot of members of the public to really connect to that and to understand that. Perfect example being the western quarter of the county or something under a warning. Does that make any sense?
I can see that with a tornado warning because it has a narrow path, but to say a severe thunderstorm is going to affect such a small portion of a county, you know, those things can blossom out and redevelop, and it's just hard to do. It's just causes so much confusion. I know sometimes I've been, of course, doing weather here all my life and know the counties. I don't know all the potholes like James does, but there are certain counties, if I hear the word East Central Randolph County, I have to think just a minute what communities those involve.
Absolutely. I have to sit there and look at a map, and I consider myself not anywhere near as geographically aware as of the state as you guys are, but it's the same thing for me. I've got to sit there and really process in my mind what the southeastern part of Shelby County, what territory that takes in. So I don't know where that's going to go.
Weather Service did a study back in the 1960s about geography, and they were appalled that most people could not name the counties that surrounded their own county.
I don't think that's changed much now.
I know there's some people that don't know the name of the county they live in, much less the ones adjacent to them. So,
and that's what kind of makes it scary, that very thing, James.
And you know, the reason people ask me, why do you say these places, these little holes in the road when you reference tornadoes? If you get on there and say there's a tornado 14 miles southwest of Maplesville, nobody knows where that is. But if you say it's at Jim's Pit Barbecue, everybody down there knows where that is. It might not mean something to somebody in Birmingham, but it means, you know, somebody there. So instead of doing this East Central County or, you know, all that, I just try and use references that everybody can understand.
Right. Judy asked me yesterday what county Trustville was in.
I don't
want to
hear.
Well, you better watch out.
I hope you knew the answer, though, right? That's the important part. Anyway,
yes.
Well,
that was, I'm in trouble.
Well, I don't know what I can do to help you on that, JB.
JB, I got a brand new basement we just finished. You're welcome to come sleep there tonight if you need to.
Okay.
Okay. We had an interesting podcast. I want to thank Dan McCarthy again with the Storm Prediction Center for being with us. Guys, any other unfinished business before we say adios?
And Tim, last week, what a doubleheader that was.
Yeah, having Tim Marshall and McCarthy back-to-back, David, that's pretty strong stuff, man.
Power hitters.
We may get President Bush next week.
Hey, no telling. I want to know where Brian Peters is. You know, last week, wasn't he down at the beach somewhere?
I am told that Brian, and I'm not making this up, is at a casino in Mississippi for 2 or 3 days, allegedly attending a conference.
Yeah.
Have you heard? I mean, come on.
You know, with him, you just never know. I mean, every time he's doing a live shot, we always have to have the camera guy pan around to be sure he's not in a Hooters parking lot. So I figured he'd be on here with us. He's also a good bandwidth stealer, but maybe we'll just debrief him next week.
I'll tell you what. Hang on a minute. I'm going to try something fiendish here.
Oh, okay. Get him on the telephone. Who else is missing, JB? We got Bill Murray gone.
I saw Bill Murray sign on a few minutes ago.
All circuits are busy. Well, we were going to try to nail Brian, and it didn't work, but we're finished.
He probably knows better.
All right. If you'd like to contact us here at WeatherBrains, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. Question@weatherbrains.com. We'll read your email and appreciate your sending it to us.
I have a friend that's a real weather geek that wants us to discuss why the word thundershower disappeared one of these days when we do Weather Brains.
We ought to do that.
We need to talk about vocabulary one night, all these word questions. That's a great subject.
Vocabulary. Sure. Vocabulary, as a teacher of mine used to say. A reminder that the opinions expressed on Weather Brains are strictly those of the people speaking and are not necessarily those of ABC 3340. For James Spann and J.B. Elliott, I'm David Black. Thank you for listening. Weather Brains is copyright 2006 by the Weather Company. All rights reserved. See you next time. Adios.